Coming up on Fronteras. About 2 months ago, the world's most wanted drug trafficker, Sinaloa cartel leader El Chapo Guzman, was captured in a joint U.S.-Mexico operation. Mexico's attorney general says he won't even consider sending Guzman to face charges in the U.S.
Yeah, I don't trust the law in Mexico because they're nothing but crooks. It is true.
The Chapo Guzman extradition debate. And it's been about a year since a formal border crossing linking Big Bend National Park and the tiny Mexican village of Boquillas del Carmen was opened.
Everybody's real happy. Everybody start coming back.
Hopes are high in the tourist town of Boquillas. Over the last decade, the economy there had crumbled, but tourist dollars have started flowing south again. We take you to that town on Fronteras. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. 2 months ago, the world's most wanted drug trafficker, Sinaloa cartel leader El Chapo Guzman, was captured in a joint U.S.-Mexico operation. Mexico's attorney general says he won't even consider sending Guzman to face charges here in the U.S. But across the border, people say they know why Mexico doesn't want Guzman to be tried outside the country. From the Fronteras desk, Lorne Madelon reports.
La captura del Chapo Guzmán y lo que representa esta captura.
February 22nd, Noticiero Television announces the capture on Mexico's Pacific coast. For 13 years, Guzmán seemed untouchable as rivals fell around him. He still enjoys near mythical status as the son of a dirt-poor farmer who made it onto the Forbes billionaires list. Several sources interviewed for this story say they know exactly why Mexican Attorney General Jesús Murillo Caram refuses to extradite Guzmán. For the record, Murillo opposes U.S. prosecutors, quote, reaching deals with criminals. He's referring to a plea deal offered to the son of Guzman's partner in return for information on the Sinaloa cartel, on its inner circle, and its alleged relationship with senior politicians over the course of 3 decades. Grand juries in Chicago, San Diego, New York, and Texas have already issued indictments against Guzman for trafficking and criminal conspiracy, including murder. In Mexico, there's a simple explanation for no extradition. This man, a judge's clerk in Chihuahua, asked that we not use his name. He says Guzman's testimony would expose the Mexican government. Drug trafficking never ends here in Mexico, he says, where dealers are close to politicians. One woman we met in Ojinaga, a border town across from Presidio, Texas, is concerned Guzman won't face a court in either country. She recalls the last time he was captured and escaped prison with overt help from the police in 2001. Like numerous Mexicans, she wonders if it will happen again.
This guy has so much money that I think he's going to go away again.
You don't trust authorities here in Mexico to keep him? Is that what you're saying, just to be clear?
Yeah, I don't trust the law in Mexico because they're nothing but crooks. It is true.
That's not a random reaction in Mexico. Javier Nieto from Sonora says, what would testimony in a U.S. court really reveal?
I mean, the worst thing that he could say was that his cartel funded, campaign of Felipe Calderon. But, I mean, just like he could say that, the same thing with the people from Cartel del Golfo, Zetas, I mean, they all fund these things, I mean, and from the very lowest levels to the very highest ranks, what are they going to do?
Until the last administration of Mexican President Felipe Calderon, Mexico believed its citizens should not be extradited to the U.S. because that would imply weakness in the Mexican judicial system. Officially, the U.S. Department of Justice says extradition is the subject of ongoing discussions between both countries. I'm Lorne Madelon in Chihuahua.
It's been a year since a formal border crossing linking Big Bend National Park and the tiny Mexican village of Boquillas del Carmen was opened. For generations, Boquillas was a popular tourist stop for visitors to the national park. But the crossing was sealed after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Over the last decade, the economy in the town crumbled. Families moved away looking for work, businesses shut down, and houses were left to the elements. But now that tourist dollars have started flowing south again, people in Boquillas say the town is coming back to life. Marfa Public Radio's Travis Bubenik has more.
It seemed oddly quiet as we crossed the Rio Grande into Boquillas on a sweltering Friday evening. Customs authorities say this crossing's averaged about 30 people a day since it opened last April, pretty much all of them coming from the U.S. side. And that's a welcome change for this tourism-dependent town that's had its economic lifeline essentially cut off for more than a decade.
Everybody's real happy. Everybody start coming back.
Ventura Falcon was born and raised here. His last name is painted on the walls of the restaurant he and his wife run. He says just about all the families that left after 9/11 have come back. Most of the people that left headed to Santa Rosa de Musquis, the nearest Mexican city, about 160 miles away. They went there for jobs in the factories, but as Falcon tells it, life there turned out to be harder than it was in Boquillas. Wages at the factory were too low. Families with four or five kids were barely getting by. And besides, Musquis just wasn't home.
They have to work in town, but they don't have any nothing over there. And in here, they got all his life, all his houses and everything.
In the past, Boquillas didn't see many Mexican tourists. But Falcon says more families have been drawn here from Mexico by how safe it is compared to other parts of the country.
And they said, we are from Mexico and we don't even know about Boquillas.
Here's a telling sign of just how dependent this town was on American tourists. Falcon says if you talk to the kids here under 12 years old, they don't speak a word of English.
Because they born or they barely 1 year old when they close the border and they never talk to the tourists.
But if you talk to the older generations, growing up bilingual was the norm. The Mexican government's funneled money and resources into Boquillas, hoping to bring more tourists here from both sides of the border and to build a more sustainable life for the people that live here. A new kindergarten has been set up along with a new clinic, and there's plans to pave the town's roads and build a solar farm. The state's governor here says that farm will be up and running by next January. But rumors circulated that the Mexican government was pulling out for the summer, so I asked Ventura about that.
I talked to those guys because lots of people, they asked me that question, and that guy, he told me, no, we're not going to leave.
Even with the upgrades here, it's still a rugged life. Michelle Lavandera is one of the town's two doctors. He says pregnant women still have to make the long trek to Musquis to give birth.
Because we don't have an environment sterile enough to deliver a baby here.
So I guess, you know, little by little, you know.
Serving up coffee at the restaurant across the street from the Falcons, Bernardo Rogel tells me the other challenge is simply letting people know the town's here.
Well, I think what we need to do is get more promotion, you know. We are ready.
But he and Falcon both say they've watched American tourists show up ready to cross the river, only to realize they don't have the passport they need to get back. But generally speaking, this unmanned experimental border crossing so far is being hailed as a success. Big Bend National Park Superintendent Cindy Ott Jones told me simply, so far, so good. Officials with U.S. Customs and Border Protection say they expect the numbers to grow, but it's not just tourism they're interested in. The agency says the new port fills what it calls a void in security on this nearly 300-mile stretch of border between Presidio and Del Rio, Texas. Boquillas isn't the only place that's been shut off from the U.S. with the tightening of the border in recent years. In 2008, the Border Patrol took down a rickety footbridge linking San Antonio del Bravo in Mexico with the small Texas town of Candelaria. The fact that two federal agencies are praising this experiment just a year later begs the question, could this type of crossing open somewhere else? Presidio Port of Entry Director Esteban Mesa says it's too soon to know.
Maybe somewhere down the road it's possible that they might look at it as a prototype, but I don't know. We're still in the learning phases.
What is clear at the moment is that the people of Boquillas will keep up their work remodeling houses and restaurants, repainting the old bar, and welcoming tourists with open arms. In Boquillas del Carmen for Marfa Public Radio, I'm Travis Bubenik.
Still more Fronteras coming up. College Week in San Antonio, Texas. It's all about getting students excited about higher ed. But the reality is families are having a hard time saving up for college.
Only about one-third of adults in Bexar County have an associate's degree or higher.
What's it going to take to get more students to college? That discussion and more on Fronteras after the break. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. All this week, the city of San Antonio has held events to encourage students to start thinking about college. There will even be a College Day signing event modeled after athletic signing days. The city's efforts even attracted the attention of and a visit from First Lady Michelle Obama. Leslie Helmkamp is a policy analyst with the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She spoke at San Antonio's College Week about ways to make college more accessible. She joins us now to tell us how students in San Antonio and Bexar County are faring when it comes to higher education.
Well, overall, in Bexar County, we're seeing that there's an overall low educational attainment in the county. We see this, though, as an opportunity. Only about one-third of adults in Bexar County have an associate's degree or higher. And then on the college pipeline data that we've looked at, only about 1 in 6 eighth graders in the San Antonio area obtain a post-secondary credential or degree. So that's after 11 years. They're tracked for 11 years and only about 1 in 6. So we have some lower levels of college attainment in the county, but there's definitely opportunity for improvement, and there's a lot of activity going on in Bexar County that we're hopeful, you know, seeing that CAFE College and the College Access Network have done some great work around FAFSA completion. You're doing much better on FAFSA completion in the state as a whole. And your two-year college enrollment rate is pretty much on par with what's going on in the rest of the state.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to expand more on that. How is Texas as a whole? How are people doing here as far as getting degrees in this Lone Star State?
Well, it's about the same. For eighth grade Texans, only about 1 in 5. So the Bexar County rate is just a little bit lower than the statewide average. Overall, we think, you know, we say we need a lot of improvement in that area if we're only graduating 1 in 5 eighth graders in the state.
So 1 in 5 eighth graders are going to get is that a 2-year or a 4-year degree?
It's any post-secondary credential or degree. So that could be community college certificate program. It could be a credential of some sort, a 2-year or 4-year degree.
So talking about this, there's obviously a lot of room for improvement. What can be done to help more people in Texas get a college degree?
Well, at the center, we focus a lot on the financial barriers to college. Absolutely, the academic preparation is really key to college access and completion, but we also really focus on what are the main barriers for many college students. And since we have a very large and growing low-income population in the state, families have fewer resources to pay for college. And so we believe it requires an approach that all stakeholders involved, colleges, institutions, the state legislature, and students and families begin to take a look at this and start early, planning early for college. That can be through basic financial education in the K-12 system. The state has already done some work on this, encouraging college savings, getting families to think early about what it's going to cost to go to college, but also to kind of break down the psychological factor that many families do overestimate college costs. So, you know, community college can be pretty affordable, but there are extra college costs that we all have to keep our eye on.
I was thinking about that. We hear a lot about college savings and people need to really put away for that early, but I'm just thinking about families who are literally having to choose between food or gas. And realistically, how can they be expected to put away for college?
Right. College savings is a really important topic, and I think that you raise a really important point. When we do this work, we've been testing out and piloting programs to see how we can incentivize college savings, and there's different ways that you can approach this. One way is through the volunteer income tax assistance sites, starting to connect folks that are filing their income tax returns, low-income families that file their income tax returns. They're going to have the largest amount of money in a given year at tax time when they receive their refunds, and we've sort of developed different pilots to encourage folks to save at that time. So that's one way, and then we've also been testing out in the K-12 system, connecting financial education with a savings account for public school students. So that's another, there's different innovative ways that we can take a look at this and see about getting families into college savings programs. And it's really not about the amount, it's more about the account, and that we begin early talking to students about what it's going to take to put a little bit away and contribute a little bit for their higher education.
Habits. It sounds like it's all about habits. So in this economy, with college being so expensive, I've read some articles and heard some stories just debating whether a four-year degree is the way to go for everyone.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We think that really the planning around college is financial, but it's also choosing your career path and what your goals are going to be. So it's not going to be a four-year degree for every occupation and every career path. And absolutely, we think that the state and investments in financial aid and those sorts of things should really go towards, you know, encouraging, you know, if there's a high demand field in a particular region of the state, that we need more folks to get certificates or credentials in those types of occupations. We should be planning and preparing for that as a state and as communities and families. So definitely the 4-year degree is not necessarily the goal for everyone in the state. It should be really a multi, they should all be prioritized, you know, for completion. We need certificates, we need degrees, you know, 2-year degrees and 4-year degrees in different industries.
That was Leslie Helmkamp, a policy analyst with the Center for Public Policy Priorities. In June, the United States will begin strict enforcement of a ban on ivory from the tusks of African and Asian elephants. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service calls what's happening to elephants today an unprecedented slaughter. But the ban's forcing musicians to make a choice: perform without their favorite instruments or give up work that takes them across the U.S. border. Lauren Madelon reports.
Stars in northern Mexico, the band Mariachi Frontera is rehearsing in front of neighbors on Calle Allende in Ojinaga, a Mexican town on the Rio Grande beside Presidio, Texas. The band is home to record an album they'd initially planned to lay down across the border in the arts mecca of Marfa, Texas. Band leader Raimundo Sevilla says ivory in his violin bows creates a sound that just can't be replicated. So he's scrapped plans to record their latest album in Texas because he doesn't want to risk getting his precious instruments confiscated. He'll still perform in the U.S., but only with non-ivory instruments. Despite the inconvenience, though, he applauds the U.S. taking a stand.
I kind of subscribe to the old adage that it's the craftsman, not the tool.
That's recording engineer Gory Smelly. Had Mariachi Frontera recorded their album in the United States, it would have been in Marfa, Texas, and they'd almost certainly have worked with him.
As a musician, I understand the difference in different instruments, and I certainly have ones I prefer, but if for whatever reason I couldn't use one, I would just have to find one that worked for me.
Musicians face the same dilemma on the northern border. That's a live performance by 25-year-old double bassist Tadis Corris, recorded in New York. A rising star, he's playing Koussevitzky's Concerto No. 1. Mm-hmm. Chorus was offered an audition with the Winnipeg Symphony in Canada, but his bow contains ivory. He declined because he was concerned his bow might be confiscated when he returns to New York.
Any musician will tell you that their instrument and their bow are very much to them like a child, and you grow accustomed to what you use to express yourself so frequently.
Antique bows were often made with a small piece of ivory that bound the bow hairs onto the wood. Chorus's bow was made in the 1950s by an instrument maker who died in 1966, but Chorus can't prove that absolutely on paper, and so the ban applies.
I truly wonder if that in and of itself is going to be in any way helping conservation. And again, I am in full support of conservation. I'm just not in support of blanket bans that are done without consideration for stakeholders.
There is a way around the ban. If musicians can prove their instrument's ivory predates 1976, they're exempt. But here's the catch. They must have documentary proof, lineage of ownership, where the instrument was crafted, next to impossible in many cases. Greg Hoover at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says there's a general lack of awareness within the music industry about instruments containing threatened wood or animal parts. He says the service is empathetic, but he says that in this case, conservation trumps convenience.
We have seen over the past 5 to 10 years a dramatic, alarming, and unprecedented increase in the slaughter of African elephants to supply the global ivory trade.
Musicians aren't the only people paying attention. U.S. antique dealers sell ivory chess sets where documentation is often elusive. And guns with ivory inlays are also now subject to the ban. I'm Lorne Madelon.
And that's it for Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows online at tpr.org under the Programs tab. If you want to share these stories with your friends on social media, there are one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. This theme music was composed by Chananga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.